From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning. It is September 11, 2018. This is Patrick Timpone. Touch and go here a minute. This morning, we lost our power in the middle of the night. I was in the sauna, actually, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and and then it came back on about 20 minutes ago. So we were about to have a day off, but much more fun doing the show. Good morning. As I said, September 11, 2018, and this is OneRadioNetwork.com. Next hour, we are going to dig further into this curious system in our body called the immune system. We kind of got onto this with Dr. Thomas Cohen, talking about vaccines and the cell-mediated immune system and antibodies and autoimmunity, this low-dose naltrexone stuff. But then really understanding more about the immune system is really key here. Wayne Blakely, the Living Streams guy, knows an incredible amount about antibodies, how they are created, why they're created, the amount of energy that they take. And so we're going to dig in next hour, and we're going to go to Immune System 101 in about 54 minutes here on One Radio Network. Well, September 11, of course, the anniversary of the tragic thing, whatever you want to call it, up in New York, I guess in 2000, I don't even know when it was, one or something, 17 years ago. And it was kind of curious. We talked to some PR people about fellow Gabriel Sed Reynolds, professor of Islamic studies and theology, University of Notre Dame. And he has a book called The Quran and its biblical subtext and the emergence of Islam. And he's editor of The Quran in the Historical Context. So he's a real, theologian and expert on these matters, professor of Islamic studies. I thought, well, September 11th, that might be a timely day to do that. And so we have him scheduled. Then I thought about this morning. I said, well, I don't know. That really doesn't, I don't know. I mean, there's never been anything proven, that anybody from Islam or anybody from the Middle East or anybody from anywhere had anything to do with September 11th. I mean, I don't want to get too far afield here, but in my opinion, the official story of 9/11 is, you don't have to go very far to know it's anything but true. We don't know who did it and why they did it and who knew, and we don't know anything. I mean, there's never been a trial. There's never been any evidence put forth whatsoever, except some things from the CIA, and their credibility these days are wanting. So who knows? So that this show is on September 11th, let's just call it a coincidence at this point, because I can't go any deeper than that. So having said that, Professor Reynolds has demonstrated a lot of imagery and different things in the Quran and the Bible and the Jewish and Christian characters. And I don't know anything about Islam. I don't know anything about the Quran. And boy, I thought, man, this would be a great time. And so let's just do it. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you.
Well, it's good that you're not at football practice this morning, because at Notre Dame, I mean, I'm sure you guys are all football-y already. It's September, right?
That's right. Yeah, football fever is around, but I'm trying to focus on theology.
Well, good for you. Good luck with that. How long have you been an Islamic studies?
Well, already as an undergraduate student, I was focusing on Islamic studies and did my PhD degree on the first Islamic book which presents the history of Christianity from a Muslim point of view. So worked on that for several years, and then 2003 started teaching here at Notre Dame.
So you did your thesis on a book that the, what was it again? Wow.
Right. So about the year 1000, a book was written by a fellow named Abdul Jabbar, not the basketball player who used to play for the LA Lakers. But he wrote a book in which he tried to advance an Islamic account for the history of Christianity.
And this is 1000 AD.
Exactly.
Theoretically, 1,000 years after the Bible. Was the Bible written like 000?
Of course, the Hebrew Bible, what Christians know as the Old Testament, was written through a course of centuries, starting around probably 1,000 B.C., continuing to the period when the Jews were in exile in Babylon, which is in the 6th century B.C., and then the New Testament is written in the second half of the 1st century A.D.
Okay, yeah, see, I don't even know from Old and New Testament, so, I guess most people don't really, So what's the difference between the Old and the New Testament?
Right. Well, the Old Testament is an account of the history of the Israelites and the relationship with God. Mm-hmm. There's many different layers and different authors, so it's pretty complicated to summarize in a word or two. You have a strand of the tradition, for example, of the first five books of the Bible, which is written by a source that's really quite ancient, probably about the year 1000, as I mentioned, which has a lot of traditions that engage with some of the myths of the ancient Near East. And then you have other writings which are focused more on the legal code, and even later than that you have wisdom writings and poetical writings, books like the Psalms and Proverbs and mm-hmm. Job, mm-hmm. which are pretty late books, so mm-hmm. Getting closer to the end of the period of B.C., the theological perspective is the divine election of Israel. This conviction of the Jewish authors that God has chosen this one people, made a covenant with this one people, imposed upon them the law, and out of love for God, they follow the law. And that's sort of the story of the Old Testament. Of course, from a Christian point of view, the New Testament authors make the case that there are prophecies in the Old Testament that the Old Testament is leading up to the New and leading up to the birth of Christ. And, of course, that's the distinct perspective of the New Testament.
Oh, wow. So this whole thing gets pretty political early on. I mean, who owns the land and all that stuff?
Well, sure, that's definitely connected to it. I mean, part of that covenant that Israel makes with God, according to the biblical narrative, what's a covenant? Covenant is a deal where each side has obligations and each side has some benefits from the whole situation. So from Israel's point of view, their obligation is to follow the law which God imposed upon them when the covenant was made in Egypt on Mount Sinai. But for the benefit they receive is God promises them that if they are faithful to the law, they will inherit the land originally promised to Abraham. So from a very sort of strict, pious point of view, religion is all about the land. That's at the heart of the matter.
And that's why it's such a mess over there with Israel and the Palestinians and all that stuff.
And that's certainly a factor. Is very, very complicated. Of course, Judaism is diverse, and there are many religious Jews who believe, indeed, that Israel's right to the land is given by God. But, of course, there are also secular Jews who consider the state of Israel basically a refuge for people who have been persecuted through the centuries. So there's a conflict there in the heart of Israeli Judaism.
So in the Old Testament, who did God appear to?
Yeah, great question. Well, I mean... So, of course, it's a question we answer theologically and not really historically, but, mm-hmm. when we look at already the first narrative of the Old Testament, the story of Adam and Eve, it's sort of a mythical tale that we read in Genesis chapter 2 and chapter 3, and God appears to Adam and Eve. God is walking in the garden. Probably the author of that tale meant it to be sort of a myth which teaches certain lessons, and not, in fact, an image of God really walking around. Probably the author realized that, theologically speaking, that's complicated or problematic. But, of course, there are particular covenants that God makes. And if you want to think about the Old Testament, that's probably the easiest optic or way of entering into the text. This history of particular deals that God makes with particular figures. So that starts with Noah after the flood, continues with Abraham, and then continues with the whole people of Israel on Mount Sinai. So there are these particular conversations or manifestations of the divine, especially to Noah, Abraham, and Moses.
Oh. Boy, you can see how that gets real real sticky, really early on as far as who the chosen people are and who owns the land and all of that.
Right, wow. Right. And keep in mind, of course, that the people of Israel, They are the descendants of Abraham's grandson, not of Abraham himself, but of his grandson. So Abraham is the father of Isaac. Isaac is the father of Jacob, and Jacob has his name changed from Jacob to Israel. He has 12 sons, and the people of Israel are the offspring of those 12 sons. So there's a particular conviction that a promise made by Abraham passed down to Isaac, to Jacob, and to his 12 sons. But of course, Abraham had other sons. He had Ishmael in addition to Isaac, and that's of course connected a bit to the story of the Arabs and Islam.
Mm-hmm. If you have some questions here, please jump in. Gabriel said Reynolds, professor of Islamic studies. Okay, so now the Quran. Just give us broad strokes about this particular book, when it came into existence.
Right. Well, we'll start, I think, the easiest way is to give the traditional Islamic perspective on the origins of the Quran. So, you know, according to the tradition, the angel Gabriel visited a man named Muhammad who was living in a city initially called Mecca, mm-hmm. in the western part of what is now Saudi Arabia. And the angel Gabriel visited him over a 23-year period between 610 and 632 A.D., so this is about 600 years after the life of Christ.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
An Islamic conviction is that, you know, God, in his inscrutable will, determined that now was the time for a new revelation, a new message to humanity. So he sent the angel Gabriel, who over this period of time visited Muhammad periodically and gave him discreet, clear messages meant for not only his people, but ultimately for the entire world. And these messages were memorized by the followers of Muhammad, and eventually, this takes place after the death of the prophet, but eventually written down around the year 650 into a book, a manuscript at the time, which Muslims call the Quran. And they call it the Quran because there are references in the scripture itself in which the text is called in Arabic Quran, a word that means recitation.
Arabic Quran?
Right.
So that means recitation, where Muhammad was literally channeling this angel. I mean, not channeling, but writing down exactly what the angel said.
Yeah. Channeling is not bad as a description. I mean, Muslims are very clear that the words that he spoke were not his. They are God's words. So the words that we find in the Quran are not the words of Muhammad or really of the angel, but ultimately of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, the channel through which they pass were from God through Gabriel and through Muhammad to the people.
Yeah. So Muhammad, this Quran, this was in 650 AD. And again, where is this in context to the Old Testament about the same? The Old Testament had already been out then.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. What was it like?
So the Bible, sorry to interrupt, the Bible comes to, the Christian Bible at least, comes to its final form in the 3rd and 4th centuries.
Okay.
And by the time Islam rises in the early 7th century, Christianity and Judaism had spread throughout the Middle East. The Bible was well known, and the Quran, you know, is engaging with these biblical traditions.
And so at that time, was there political issues with the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims in the 7th century? Did they start fighting over stuff at that point?
Certainly. I mean, the relationship between Christianity and Judaism is complicated and fraught from the beginning.
Well, I bet.
The first Christians, of course, were Jews who accepted the gospel or the message about Jesus. But many of them continued to practice the Jewish law, still believed that to be right with God, you still have to obey the covenant made with Moses, even if you've embraced faith in Jesus. And then, you know, over the centuries, Judaism and Christianity split apart, and Christians follow a position basically that the religion is about grace and spirit and not about law.
Mm-hmm.
Jews remain faithful to the law. But Christians, of course, with the ascension of the Emperor Constantine, established political authority, and Jews are often persecuted at the hands of Christians. So already when Islam is around, there's a history of tension, a complicated history between Judaism and Christianity. And things get more complicated when Islam emerges, because, of course, Islam emerges with conquest. In the second half of Muhammad's career as a prophet, he receives messages that warfare in the name of God is permitted, with certain restrictions. You know, it's not just violence, but is permitted. In the line of earlier prophets who went to war for God, like Moses and Joshua. And so Islam begins with a series of conquests, and so these tensions begin quite early in the history of Islam.
I see. Professor, I kind of lost. When does Muhammad come in? We have Gabriel and Abraham writing the Quran, correct?
No, that's Gabriel transmitting messages to Muhammad.
Oh, I thought it was Abraham. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So no problem, but just to step back. Yeah. So according to the traditional biography of Muhammad, he's born in the year 570 AD.
570.
And he lives for 40 years as someone who has sort of an instinctual notion of monotheism or divine oneness, but has not yet been called to a new religion. And when he's 40 years old, he's meditating in a cave on a mountain outside of Mecca, and the angel comes to him for the first time.
It's fascinating. Do you know how many stories are like that around the world?
Right.
With other religions? Lhotse, one of my teachers, in a cave, you know, and was taken out of his body and shown some things, and the animals took care of him. And there's other, in the Buddhists and Taoists. I mean, this story has been around a long time, with this happening to people.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
A lot of different...
Yeah, there are certain motifs or themes which absolutely repeat themselves. And, you know, just the notion of a mountain and a cave and
right,
the angel.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
All the time. A lot of it. And then I think the 3 days, you know, the whole thing with Christ and being killed and then rise, you know, coming back again. That's been talked about in different spiritual paths since the beginning of time as well. Way before the Bible. Way before the Bible.
Right.
Yeah. So there's something going on here. does it sound like to you, I don't want to get too simplistic, but it's all the same thing and just different stories told in different ways? I know that's kind of a dinner conversation kind of question.
But. Yeah, well, no, it's a very interesting thing to sort of reflect on. You know, what we find in the different traditions, at least of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are shared characters, shared stories, but some contention over the meaning of those stories and the teaching of those characters. So there is sort of a common foundation. But when it comes to the question of interpretation and application, there's serious tension that, you know, we can't completely explain away. So, for example, the figure of Jesus becomes an issue of great contention between the three traditions.
Yeah, the contention, correct me if I'm wrong, the contention, the problem, if there's a problem here with this all this stuff, is that one group thinks that theirs is the only way or the right way and the other ones are not right. I mean, that's the problem.
Right.
Is that
right.
The problem?
Well, yes. I mean, that's certainly the case. I mean, just to take the case of Jesus, you know, from a Jewish perspective, Jesus is not the Christ, was not the Messiah, not the one that God had promised would come into the world. From a Christian perspective, not only is he Christ, but he's also divine. And from a Muslim perspective, he's a prophet, who's come to reaffirm the law of Moses and predict the coming of Muhammad. So we have three distinct perspectives, and usually, historically, you know, the position of Jews, Christians, and Muslims is what, I mean, basically what you're saying, but to use a fancy term, what people would call exclusivism.
Exclusivism, that's a nice
word. We're completely right, and you're completely wrong.
Right. Can you stay right there, sir? I want to do a quick little break, commercials.
Sure.
All right, start right there. This is fun. Gabriel Said Reynolds, professor of Islamic studies and theology at the University of Notre Dame. Again, I just want to repeat in case you just tuned the show. I mean, I thought it'd be fairly interesting to do a show like this on, you know, the 17th anniversary of 9/11 because of, well, you know, Quran and Islam. And then I thought this morning I was washing the dishes and the lights were out and didn't even think we were going to do the show. I said, well, maybe it's just kind of a divine intervention here, because, I mean, everything that I've read and had people on the show over the last 17 years, let's see, how can I say this and be nice? My opinion, the official story of 9/11 is not even close to being true. We have no idea what happened, who was involved, who did it, why they did it, where they did it, how they did it, who knew. None of that is known. The only thing we have is the official story from, the CIA in the United States, and, when's the last time you believe something that these people said? So I thought, well, maybe this is just divine intervention that our power went out this morning. Last night we weren't going to do the show, and then it popped back on 20 minutes before. So that's just a little side note, so I don't want to, whatever. Okay, let's do this. I think it's fair to say that most of us would like to have more energy to do what we do. We recently talked with Living Streams' Wayne Blakely about this idea. So the body's set up to get rid of pathogens or toxins if it has the bacteria or the biome?
The bacteria and the nutrients. That's what it does. What the digestive is. It's 70 to 80% of your immune system, your digestive tract. Backup systems are your antibodies. That's when everything else fails. And the primary system is your digestive tract.
If the digestive system is so compromised because of all whatever glyphosates, antibiotics, and all the things we stress and bad food and whatever, then the body will produce antibodies to try to protect it from assaults?
That when it gets overgrown, instead of balancing the body like it's supposed to, it gets into a critical stage where the antibody starts to reduce. So when your body creates an antibody, it takes more energy to create an antibody than any other function of the body. It has to create it from scratch. The antibodies are working overtime on everybody. And that's why everybody's so tired all the time. That's one of the reasons.
Could be one of the reasons why many people, including Patrick, feels better and has more energy taking these Living Streams probiotics. If you'd like to learn more, you can call Marilyn at 360-912-2981. 360-912-2981 with Living Streams. She'll give you some particular information about various probiotics in the Living Streams corral of products, and they're all in our store on OneRadioNetwork.com. We are going to be talking with Wayne Blakely, not necessarily about Living Streams as products, but about the immune system, and we're going to learn about antibodies. I mean, a lot of people think that ants are very, very healthy because they have a tiny amount of tiny antibodies, but it's just, I wouldn't believe that. They have tiny. Forget it. You had to be there. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. We started a whole program with Dr. Ellie Phillips. I guess it's been a couple years ago. Or has it been 1 year? I don't know. You know me, I don't do time. I don't believe in time, so I don't have any idea. When we did some, I asked friends of mine, or Sharon, I said, when did I do that? And was that 2 years ago? She said, no, Patrick, that was 5 years ago. I don't do the time thing well because I just don't care about time. Anyway, we went through the whole thing with Dr. Ellie Phillips and doing her whole program on the teeth and, get the gums to kind of get back all happy and shiny, and went through this whole program. And now I kind of fell off that bandwagon, as much respect as I have for this dear lady, because I just didn't want to do the fluoride thing. Several of her products in the protocol had fluoride, and I just couldn't get my head around that after a while. But then we came across Pearlseum, which is this pearl product that I just really recommend that you try. Just trust me on this one. If you never trust me on something, just trust me on this one. And if you want to try something really cool about for your teeth, is get a product called Closest. You get it at Walgreens or somewhere, a drugstore. Closest, which is just a chlorine dioxide, which brings more oxygen. It's kind of what it is. What Miracle Mineral Supplement, or MMS, is made out of. Miracle Mineral Supplement. It's called Closest, and you can rinse your mouth out with this Closest. And then get some Pearlseum from our website. I would get the two-pack, where you get a really nice deal, a discount of about $60. Get two containers of this Pearlseum, and it's just pearl that's been powdered in a special way where it retains all the crystalline structure of a pearl. This is real pearl, not mother of pearl or some made-up stuff that they make in a lab. This is real living pearl, and then brush your teeth with that. You do that twice a day, and your teeth are going to look better, feel better, be more pearly, more shiny, more like, and it's even better than the movie star look, because the movie star look is kind of like white, because in my opinion, these people bleach their teeth is what they do, which is it looks fake. This is more pearly because this is really helping to put a nice hard surface and to fill in a little bit of the grooves that get put in teeth because of acids and on all the silly stuff we do. And if you use chalk in your toothpaste, which we don't recommend, it actually scratches the surface of the tooth. Yep, and it inhibits the shine, but it will make them a little bit more white. That's what toothpaste does and why we don't use it. Anyway, try some of this. Just trust me on this one. Pearl Sim, it's on the front page. When you get on there, however, I haven't changed it yet. Just get on there and find the two-pack and order that one. And I think you'll like that better than... No, you get a better deal. Get the two-pack.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
All right, Gabriel Sed Reynolds is professor of Islamic Studies Theology. He is the author of the Quran and its Biblical Subtext and the Emergence of Islam, and he's editor of the Quran in its Historical Context. So I'm trying to get my head around a lot of this. There's a lot of information here. So Gabriel appeared to Muhammad over 40 days or something, and he kind of translated what essentially then the Gabriel, what were some of the key points that Gabriel told Muhammad?
Right, so the tradition is that the angel Gabriel appeared to Muhammad. He would come down at certain occasions, mm-hmm. but these occasions lasted for 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
So from the year 610 AD to the year 632.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal message of the book, the principal argument of Islam, is to worship God alone,
mm-hmm.
and to acknowledge the message of the prophet sent to you. And that involves obeying the commands of the prophet and following the law, which is taught by the prophet. Then the Quran sort of adds on. So that's sort of the message. And the Quran gives certain reasons to believe in this message. So it constructs arguments. The Quran is really, the heart of the Quran are these series of arguments, which are advanced to convince the audience that indeed you should believe in God alone and obey the prophet. And there's sort of three of these arguments. The first is the Quran tells stories of earlier peoples, some of whom we may know from the Bible, such as the people of Noah, and we know the story of Noah's Ark, who were destroyed because they refused to listen to a messenger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of reason number one. Reason number two, the Quran reflects on heaven and hell and gives really sort of detailed descriptions of what paradise is like and what hell is like.
Uh-huh.
And then reason number three, the Quran points to nature. The Quran looks at or draws its audience's attention to the good things in nature, especially the ability to produce food from crops,
mm-hmm.
and says, listen, God has provided this for you. Are you going to be grateful or ungrateful to God's blessings?
Okay.
So these are sort of a series of arguments which don't appear one after another in the book. They're interspersed throughout the whole book. If I could just add what you find in the book that I've written, which is called The Quran and the Bible, is a whole translation of the Quran. But what makes it more user-friendly is that translation is interrupted by passages from the Bible which are connected to passages from the Quran. So those biblical passages really help to shine light on the meaning of the Quran and allow it to be, especially to an audience that's not coming from a Muslim tradition,
mm-hmm.
allow them to understand the text.
I see. So what are some of the things that kind of are together or are tied in with the Bible? Some ideas, some stories. You mentioned Noah and, of course, heaven and hell. I mean, that's pretty good connection, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Sure.
And then the only God, too. I mean, isn't what's the first commandment? First commandment is, there's, I don't even know what it is anymore.
Right. I'm the Lord your God.
I'm the Lord
another
God. So that also fits, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. And that's the basic argument of my book, The Quran and the Bible, that the Quran is coming straight from the heart of the biblical tradition. So, you know, sometimes in the West, we think of the Quran as something foreign, something very, very different, but it's really in an intimate conversation with biblical stories. So starting from the beginning, I mean, a good place to start is the story of Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Adam and Eve feature also in the Quran. They're also in a garden. They're also tempted, not by a serpent, as they are in the book of Genesis, but simply by Satan. They give in to the temptation. They fail to be obedient to God, and they fall from the garden and enter into the world. So that story is already there. But it's interesting. The Quran tells other stories about Adam and Eve, or about Adam in particular, which we don't find in the Bible. For example, the Quran tells a story according to which God commanded the angels to bow down before Adam, to prostrate themselves before Adam. And there was only one angel who refused to do that, and you might guess which one that was. That was the devil,
mm-hmm.
Because of his disobedience and stubbornness, he's sent out of heaven and becomes an exile from the heavenly realm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've often... Well, it's so fascinating.
Right.
So after Muhammad did this, then he was the prophet, and how long did he live? And then did somebody take over after him?
Right, so Muhammad dies, according to the traditional date, in 632 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
He dies, you know, he began his career in a city named Mecca, which people might recognize. You know, when Muslims go on pilgrimage, they go to Mecca, and most of the pilgrimage rites, well, some of them at least, are centered around a building known as the Kaaba, a black building. But Muhammad was only there for 12 or 13 years, and he then migrated to a city to the north in Medina, and that's where he lives, spends the rest of his life, and dies. And after his death in 632, there was a dispute at the heart of the Islamic community that's connected to the division between Sunnis and Shiites today.
Oh, that's where that started.
Exactly. So in the figure who entered into power, his name is Abu Bakr. He was a friend of Muhammad. Now, Sunnis say this was a good thing, that the community came to a consensus and chose a political successor, and that this man, Abu Bakr, became leader. But Shiites say it shouldn't have been Abu Bakr. Muhammad himself had designated his cousin, whose name was Ali, to take over the leadership of the community.
His name was what? Ali?
Yeah, A-L-I, right.
Oh. Well, that's not going to end well, right? So this is where we are today with the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Exactly. We're in a period of Islamic history where, you know, academic scholars feel a little bit hesitant about the reliability of some of the narratives, some of the accounts. So it's hard to know if things really went down this way.
But yeah, of course.
These are the traditional stories that Sunnis and Shiites will point to in describing the origins of Islam. And so they would find the split between Sunnis and Shiites right there at the moment of the Prophet's death.
So when Muhammad died, then who was gonna take over?
Exactly.
And they said it was Ali, one side, and the other side went for who?
Abu Bakr, B-A-K-R.
But these were just prophets. See, were these like meant to be in the realm of sons of God, like Jesus is purported to be, the only begotten son?
Yeah, Islam is very strict. You know, the heart of the Islamic message is, in fact, a refutation of Christian teaching. And this notion that there's a great division between God, who's transcendent, who's other, who's sublime, and humanity. So that distance is very important for the Quran's way of seeing the world. And so the notion that, you know, God could become incarnate, that God could go from heaven and enter into earth, is seen not only as impossible or irrational, but actually as an insult to God.
Yeah.
And we have some passages which seem to be pretty clear that that very teaching is belittling God. God is above that sort of thing. He's in heaven. He's pure spirit. And these Christians have this idea of God becoming man. So the Quran is sort of fiercely opposed to this doctrine of Christianity.
Well, I probably wouldn't get along very well over there. I think that we're all this pure spirit and we're all sparks of God. Man, I'd be in big trouble over there.
Well, there are mystical traditions in Islam. If you ran into some mystics,
yeah,
you might be able to make some connections there.
Yeah. Got to be careful who you say that stuff to over there. Wow, man. So the in Islam, they have this image, or you tell me, of a space god, much like God the Father in the Christian, where this might be this huge being somewhere other than where they are, with a beard and the whole thing.
Yeah, well, okay, so that's a tricky one. Very interesting. So at least from the Islamic point of view, there's disputes over the nature of God, whether God has any physical features. So it's actually something that's debated. Hmm. You know, the Quran uses what, just to use a very fancy term, uses what we call anthropomorphic language for God.
Right. So tell folks what that is. Yeah.
Yeah, it gives God certain human features. It describes God's hands, for example. It even has God sitting down. And so there's some suggestion from a literal reading that God could, maybe in a different way or an unusual sort of way, but could actually have a physicality and could be seen,
yes,
by the blessed when they enter paradise.
Yeah.
And that becomes a really intense theological debate. Can you see God or not? And different schools will have different traditions. And there are other traditions in Islam that say, yes, even if there's this anthropomorphic language about God, we have to interpret that rationally and understand that that's just metaphor and symbol, and God is pure spirit and cannot be seen, has no beard, and no physicality.
Wow. As a theologian, you may enjoy this little side note. In my spiritual tradition, which is Ekinkar, we learned, Professor, how to literally soul travel, where you leave your body, right, at night.
Okay.
And you
go
out and you go to the different levels of reality, the astral plane, the causal, the mental, right, spiritual. And there are different, you know, to give these people a little, a little credibility, St. Paul and other people who saw the light and people probably from the Quran, there are beings on other planes of reality that are these huge space gods. I mean, they exist. There's one that's called Kal Naranjan, which is also called the devil. There's one called Satnam, and you know, one hair of his head is like 1,000 suns, and you know, he's like as big as a mountain. You know, these people really do exist. So you know, it's no surprise that some of these prophets and spiritual people meditated and saw some of these things and these people and talked about it. So, you know, it works for me. But they're not really the God, you know.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They're just steps along the way. You know, they're just steps along the way.
Okay.
You know
okay.
what I'm saying? I don't know for what that's worth, you know. I know it's true. so you can imagine how people can be confused and be told, no, I saw God, you know. And St. Paul, you know, I think he did. He was in the third heaven, you might remember, the third heaven, which would be the causal plane.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
St. Paul in the third heaven. So one of the things you hear most often, I love to listen to talk radio, being in it so long, and drive around and punch around, you know, in talk shows, that if you hear one meme more than anything when it talks to Islam, or especially around this time of 9/11 and all that, is well, you know, in the Quran, you know, they say that we just have to kill all the infidels, all the Western people. I mean, you hear that a lot, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that true?
Yeah, of course it's not true. And just to keep
so
in
that's
mind
fake
that
news. It's fake news. It's kind of glad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is dangerous stuff. We have to keep in mind that there are, you know, Muslims are about 2% of the American population now, just citizens, not thinking of those who don't have citizenship yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, about 7 million of our fellow Americans are Muslims, and they're our neighbors and friends, and they play on soccer teams with our kids, mm-hmm. and they're coworkers, and they work in all domains of society, from medicine to everything else. And so, and you know, they're fully engaged in American society. They're in the military. It's just ridiculous to think that there's some proclivity towards violence in the religion. I mean, if that were the case, there would be chaos. I mean, in fact, you know, they're going to work every day and playing with their kids, and so that, you know, that's hyperbole and borders on bigotry. That notion, you know, that's around.
Right.
You know, having said all of that, still, you know, from my perspective, it's important to respect that there are different currents in Islam, and there is one current within Sunni Islam, known as Salafism.
Salafism?
Salafism, yeah. S-A-L-A-F, Salafism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one current in Sunni Islam which is really animated by this notion that there's a fundamental division between the believers and the unbelievers. They're in, you know, perpetual competition. And there are some Salafis, and this is where the tradition of bin Laden comes in. Mm-hmm. There are some Salafis that are embrace violence as a way of leading Islam to victory over the unbelievers. These are known as Salafi jihadis. That does exist. They're not, there is a minor part of the Islamic community worldwide. They have almost no followers in the United States, but in some countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and other places, they are a presence. And so, I mean, there are issues out there. We shouldn't, you know, imagine that there's no problem there. There are, but that should be understood as a Salafi jihadi problem and not an Islamic problem. Mm,
a Salafi jihadi problem, right. So when you say non-believers, these folks believe that if you don't believe exactly the way they do, which would include, I guess, all Christians and Jews and Buddhists and anybody, then you're a problem for them. And they have the right to kill you? Would you go that far? Or attack
yeah, even,
you? Or?
Even they would say that there are certain restrictions. You can't just go around killing anyone. But there are certain notions. For example, retribution is an important notion in Salafi jihadism. So if there's a sense that there's a threat against Muslims or an injustice against Muslims, then any Muslim has the right to take out, from their perspective, right, from the Salafi jihadi perspective, this is not Islam in general, any Muslim who follows this path has the right to take out retribution against the offenders. But they would be careful to say this is retribution. So even when Bin Laden, you're spoken about some doubts about 9/11, but in his statements, when he's defending, certain attacks, not only 9/11, he often appeals to this. He says, listen, the United States and its allies have killed innocent Muslims. They didn't care about civilians, and so we don't care about civilians. So this notion of retribution justifies the use of violence.
Sure, sure. And and the West, and you know, certainly true, has done a lot of damage to these people over the years. You know, UK was in there, 100 years ago, looking, you know, dividing up the country and who gets this piece for this much oil. Goes way back, you know. Why these people wouldn't be angry, some of them, I'd be very surprised if they wouldn't.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you feel as a theologian, a more personal question, and seeing where we are in 2018, where this whole thing is somehow, through the magic of the media, morphed into terrorism, you know, these terrorism as the evil thing, and then all they always showing these people with beards who kind of look the same way, you know, and have a turban on and stuff, and it's really just, to me, it's very, I don't even know what the word is, the way it's morphed into. How does that? Can you comment on what I'm trying to say here?
Well, what's happened in recent decades is we have a rise of this movement within Sunni Islam. Again, this is only Sunni Islam. It's not Shiite Islam, which is known as Salafism. So that's the larger movement. And as I mentioned, Salafi jihadism is only one aspect of this movement, or one movement within the movement. But the rise of Salafism means that there are more conservative Muslims You know, and conservatism and piety is on the rise generally. You know, you can see this symbolically with more beards among men and more headscarves among women. Mm-hmm. And that's a trend throughout the Islamic world, from Nigeria to Indonesia. And so, you know, these external signs, which sort of make the Muslims seem more an other, more different, more strange from a Western point of view, you know, that's led in certain sort of caricatures in the West to, you know, Westerners looking at Muslims as not only other, but somehow a threat.
Yes,
The beard and the headscarf are, for some reason, are imagined to be a threat, which, of course, they're not. It's just a beard and a headscarf. That's all it is. So it's that leap, I think, where the problem is, that the other or someone who's different is necessarily a threat, which simply isn't the case.
And I think it's fair to say that governments around the world have used this to promote their war efforts, whatever they may be, all around the world, all governments, right?
Well, it certainly has been used to justify or to by certain regimes in the Middle East, like the Assad regime in Syria. You know, the basic argument they've made is the world needs to rally around us because we are the only hope for fighting those fundamentalists, you know. So
finding the jihadists.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. And so even no matter how bad Assad has been, he's your least bad choice, and you must rally around him. So that case has been made a lot.
Yeah. But then you start adding pipelines in Russia and all this stuff, and who's fighting over what, and oil and natural gas, and boy, no wonder it's a mess. I mean, no wonder it's a mess. Huh?
Right. Right. Yeah, so politically it gets very, very complicated with all of the different rivalries and complicated relationships between on the religious and political level.
Yeah. So, well, I think it's fair to say that I guess in the Middle East, and politics and religion are one and the same, which is, that started way back with Muhammad when he died.
Yeah, there is an Islamic tradition that says precisely that. That Islam is both a religion and state. Mm-hmm. So in Arabic, the expression is deen wa dawla. Islam is religion and state.
Religion and state.
And I remember, you know, when I had a Muslim teacher in Beirut, Lebanon, he would tell me, you know, you Christians have this notion of give unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right, right.
Right. But he would say, but this is a Christian notion. We don't share that at all. That's in your gospel. It's not in the Quran. And, you know, Islam holds that God has given guidance for both people's individual spiritual lives, but also for the administration of society as a whole. And that guidance is known as the Sharia, the Islamic law, and that we're called to follow God in private and public matters. So that was his argument. Now, not all Muslims look at things that way. There are some Muslims who are secular, and even if they, you know, believe in God and pray, they would say, but I'm a secular person. I believe state and religion should be separate. So, you know, the closer you look at it, the more complicated it gets.
Yeah. I guess no wonder the founding fathers tried to put that in their separation of church and state, right, in the Constitution.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, they probably kind of knew what they were talking about.
Could be.
So all the people that the United States politically are not so friendly with, are they Sunnis? Are they like Iran, Sunnis?
Yeah, Iran is Shiite.
Or the Shiite.
Yes, Iran is the largest Shiite country in the world. And so that's a distinct story. What happens in Iran is in the late 1970s, there's the revolution, of course, there, the Islamic revolution.
Right.
And that leads Shiites to embrace a more robust, politically minded version of Islam. But it doesn't mean that Iran has been involved in different terrorist attacks. Even in Iran, where, you know, religion and state are basically one, where there's a supreme council of religious leaders who oversee all of the political and military matters in Iran, you know, even there, Iran and Shiism generally has not been involved in this movement of Salafi jihadism, which leads to attacks against civilians around the world. So we have to be careful there. I mean, it doesn't mean that there are no problems with Iran. There are complications there, too. There's freedoms which are being suppressed in Iran, but they have not been involved in terrorist attacks.
There's something going on in Iran that I guess it's, when did they put in the Shah? When did the United States put this guy in?
Well,
I'm glad we don't meddle in elections, but we just put him in.
Easier that way.
Yeah. When did they put him? Was it in the 40s, well, Professor? No.
Even early in the beginning of the 20th century, wow, is when the beginning of the dynasty that falls finally in 1979 with the Islamic Revolution.
So no wonder these people kind of got a thing, a thorn in their side for the United States, right? I mean, or the West. You can imagine all the meddling that the West has done in that country. True.
Right, and that renders the situation for liberals and those who would like to see the Islamic regime overturned in Iran, that makes it very complicated for them, because when they speak up and they say, we don't want to live in an Islamic state, we want our freedoms back, they're immediately accused of being pawns of the United States. So, ironically, that makes things complicated for the very people we would like to support.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it sure is a curious world we've found ourselves in.
That's right.
Well, this has been very interesting. I've learned a lot here. I appreciate it. Tell us a bit, before you go, a bit more about your book and why some of our listeners around the world might want to get it, what they're going to find there.
Great, thank you. Yeah, the book is called The Quran and the Bible. It presents an English translation, a really good, clear English translation of the Quran, along with biblical texts and commentary, which help make the Quran even easier to understand. It's a big book, you know, but it's not very expensive. You can find it on Amazon or anywhere else online, and it's meant for the general audience and hopefully will help people understand the relationship between these two scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Professor Reynolds, thank you so much. Gabriel Said Reynolds, for coming on the show, and I know that you had to rearrange a few things to be here, so we appreciate it, sir.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, that was pretty interesting, huh? Wow. Well, I knew nothing about that whole thing, and it'll broaden your strokes a little bit. You know, it's really interesting, too, about Gabriel and coming to Abraham and, you know, translating and just dictating a bunch of things. And there's all kinds of examples of this throughout spiritual history, of different spiritual masters coming to people and translating what they believe is the truth of things. But it's happened a lot. One of my teachers, Reba Zartarzu, who's, I think he's about 1,500 years old. He's had a body 1,500, but he can move around in the ethers. And he came into one of my other teachers, Paul Twitchell, used to pop in there and over a period of a few years and translated a book called Dialogues with the Masters. And interesting thing to keep in mind is, just in the case of Reba Zartarzu and anything, you know, and other people that have done this in the yogic traditions, that's just because people have the ability to, you know, to come in and do a thing. How can I say this without, angels are angels and Reba Zartarzu are Reba Zartarzu and they're God-realized beings, but they're also giving their interpretation and their experiences with the God worlds and not necessarily have written down things what Big God, whatever that is, told them. So it's, you know, these things are so fascinating to look at, but it's important to be very open and just ask questions and contemplate on these ideas rather than take a big strong position, because you're gonna get in trouble when you do. Wayne's on the line and we'll start him in a minute. I always remember we were going to an Ekankar worldwide seminar in October in 2001, I guess, 1 month after 9/11, the whole thing the tower thing happened. And our teacher, Sri Harold Klemp, he works with us on the inner planes, and also then he teaches on the outer. And so he's the inner master as well, and comes to us and on the, you know, on the inner planes, and gives us, you know, say, check this out over there. That doesn't tell us what to do, but guides us. He's a way shower. But we're all kind of expecting, he'd say something about, you know, the 9/11 thing. And he alluded to it at the beginning of his talk. And the only thing he said was, just don't get involved. Just don't get involved. That's all he said. So I always remember that. And it's probably, it's been a good thing for me to remember. Just don't get involved. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Now we are going to talk about, we're going to switch gears here, talk about the immune system. And remember that one of the reasons why ants, you know, are, don't get sick very often, because they have a very tiny amount of antibodies, tiny antibodies. No, that's not